Welcome to the Hospitality Podcast.
Where's the lamb sauce?
Come on, man.
I just need a...
This is the lamb
sauce. Where's the lamb sauce?
Presented by Arthur Gomez.
God damn, I just spent $8,000 on f***ing wine.
And Quentin Wind.
What are you?
An idiot sandwich.
So pour yourself a glass, because we're diving into the world of restaurants, kitchen and bar. The Hospitality Podcast.
Welcome to Breaking the Cork, another episode. And this time we've got the CMO of Grind. And this is Ted Robinson. Hey, Ted.
Thank you for coming. Welcome, Ted.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
Thank you very much for coming. And I would say non-chef, wine related. And we're, diving more into, I would say, the back office in that sense.
Yeah, I guess so.
Entrepreneurship, yeah. Marketing, business.
That other side of the front of the house. And what is really interesting in terms of your profile is that you've done it all at Grind. And we've heard from previous podcasts that you've been with Grind for 11 years and you started in the Shoreditch branch.
Yeah, like when I was about 21. And to be honest, I wish I had a bit more of a, romantic story where I ended up there. But really, I was like, I was at university. I was 21. I needed the money. Like, I needed a job, right? I think we've all been there in that position once upon a time.
That's fair.
And then, and it was like, I lived around the corner from there. Every day I'd go and walk to Old Street Station, which, to be fair, in 2011 was quite a different place. I'd get on the tube there up to King's Cross where I went to university. And then, I was going in there every day. It's probably, at the time, the cafe was about a year old. Mm. And I'd say that coffee in London was in quite a different place. Like, it was right next door to a big Starbucks. And there was a lot like going on in the area with things arriving and all kind of development going on. I'm to be honest, as there still is now. But yeah, and so I was a customer, to be honest. I was up for a good few months there. I'd go in every day, grab a flat white on my way to university. And then as I needed a job, I got to a point where I knew a couple of staff there. And I think I picked up some shifts at some point. I don't think I ever had a job interview. But to be honest, obviously, compared to Grind now, it's quite different. But it was a very, like, all the people who worked there were friends. I was there for a couple of years. And then I worked with the founder to raise some money to open some of the other ones.
Okay. So back then, 11 years ago, how many Grind's cafe bar shops?
There was one. It was one, and it was tiny. It was like, we just added a bar. So it was a cafe. It employed maybe 7 or 8 people.
Oh, wow.
Oh, so very small.
It was
scales.
Really a completely different business back then. It was like, the founder had just basically, he still had a job full time in the city, and he opened it in his, what used to be his dad's mobile phone shop. Mm. Like, his dad sadly passed away, and he basically turned what was the shop into a little cafe. And it was very much like seat of the pants. So like a couple of the staff are coming from Australia, and they were just figuring it out. It was really like early stage.
Yeah.
But also, it was such a different time for coffee in London. Well, it was just super hipster. It was like people just figuring it out. A flat white was, I don't know, $2.50, probably half of what it is now.
Good time.
I worked there for a while. Like, I had some of the best time of my life working there. It was just really good fun. And like, just coming in there, and like, I got to know a lot of the customers really well. I got to know all the staff really well. Like, just I had a really good time.
Yeah. So you really bonded with the owner.
Yeah.
And then he obviously he saw something in you.
Yeah, absolutely.
So you did mention early on that you did everything in Grind, so you went through different positions.
Yeah.
So do you want to...
So he raised the money to open the next couple, which was the first of which was more of a cafe in Soho. And then a bit later on, we opened what was a bit more of a full restaurant that's still open on London Bridge. So we got that on London Bridge, so literally looking over the river.
Yeah.
And yeah, it was probably not until we probably had 70 or 80 staff before it came to the point where I wasn't writing the rota and doing the payroll, which looking back was wild, given that I was just a kid at the time, to be honest.
Yeah.
I think that we, even before we opened any other sites, we started opening in the evenings as a bar, and we worked on developing what that offering was going to look like. And that was, again, not even done out of any real desire to be a bar, but rather, hey, look, we're paying this rent. We need to make more money through the evenings. And to be honest, similarly, it was when we opened more of a restaurant. But yeah, and it was really great to go, even my time there, to go from washing dishes to a point where I was managing the staff and doing the payroll. Mm. And I think I was really lucky that I'm the pretty much the perfect story of getting in on the ground floor, right? I was really early into it, and I found my way very luckily to the top of it quite early on.
Yep.
And have fortunately managed to remain there for another 10 years since. Obviously, my role's really evolved in that time. So I think quite quickly, I took on a lot of the kind of brand and marketing stuff. Like when we just had one cafe, I think I made our first Instagram account. And of course, again, I mean, it's a different world back then, right? Like now you like, I think for a long time, we have more followers than Starbucks on Instagram, which is just crazy to think about now. And then and obviously like over time, it became, I think like back then you opened a Instagram account for your cafe and now you open a cafe for your Instagram
for
account.
Instagram account.
Yeah, it's just, yeah. And it's crazy to see the way that stuff like that, and even just like, I mean, thinking about a lot of friends of mine who work in like restaurant marketing, and you think about how crazy that is now compared to what it was like 10 years ago, people writing like reviews and stuff. And now it's just like the whole thing is now basically online. Things blow up on TikTok or whatever.
Like then it was TripAdvisor, really.
Yeah, it's like, yeah.
It was the only website where you can find like review about the restaurant.
And it's like people like submitting photos or people like tagging it on Foursquare.
Now you're paying people to go to a restaurant and to take photos.
That's crazy.
So before you joined Grind, you say you were studying.
Okay,
university. Did you used to study marketing by any chance?
I was basically studying like history of art. When I was a teenager, I was always like, I think like my first job when I was 16 is I had like a job, like I had a job on the door of a nightclub where and I was always in bars or for a while I worked for like a festival, like a kind of a large, quite a big festival in the north of the UK, even when I was like 18 or so. And I had a couple of people there, like through that journey of that I got on with really well and also just probably made me who I am. But it was people who I was lucky to find some employers there who really championed me. And I worked really hard at making myself invaluable, but also like people like David at Grind or people like, I mean, there was a woman called Sarah who used to run, or Sarah Nolte used to run a festival in the UK. And she like really just, I mean, she met me when I was 17 and she was like, yeah, cool, I'll make this guy assistant festival director. And you're like, okay, great. I'm sure I was absolutely useless. But I don't know. I think anyone in any job, you need someone to like pick you out from there.
See some skills on you, some potential.
But also just show up for you, right? It's like just like, I think that obviously as I get older, I know that there are people around me that I'm like, oh, like I'm going to show up for you here in a way that perhaps even if you don't show up for yourself, like I want to champion you as someone who I think like really respects and someone I think is going to be doing some stuff, do some really exciting things in the future. Yeah.
Well, congratulations for that, though.
Yeah, it's good. It's really nice. It's been good fun.
So as a chief marketing officer, is that where you want to be right now? Or is there more to grow and you want to go to a next?
I don't know, really. It's a funny title, particularly in a business like ours. But then again, like we're quite a unique. Obviously, so in the time since where I left off there, I think we've opened a number of locations and that probably takes us up for probably the next 7 or 8 years there, where we get to about 2018, 2019. And we suddenly look at the business we've got and we're going, look, we've got this great brand. People want to buy our t-shirts, want to buy our tote bags if we make them. Yeah. And we've got this amazing coffee roastery full of people who are so passionate about the product and know so much about it. But we are in a really tough business, right? Like it's like whether you're serving in a cafe, serving coffee, serving cocktails, serving food, like you're really like for every pound you take, you're paying 30p if it goes to your rent, 30p if it goes to your staff, at least 30p if it goes, like the best possible case of it all going right is you're squeezing out a little margin on the top of it. And also we had that, just the challenge of the fact that we were a business that you had to drag people by hook or by crook to one of these, at the time, 9 physical locations so that they could give us their money, which was quite scary. So we worked with some guys in Europe to make a compostable Nespresso pod. And to be honest, like today the business makes more revenue on those pods than we do in our cafe and our restaurants.
So what was the turning, like how did that come about?
For the first year, probably 2019, it was like a pet project, right? It was literally, we were borrowing the time of people in the business to help us out with this little side project we had. And then probably, obviously, when lockdown came around, I think like a lot of people, like lockdown was probably the worst. That first week of lockdown, I think I can remember because my mum came to visit me in London the weekend before it all happened. And it was like Friday, we had a great Friday. By the weekend, it got a little bit soft over the weekend. And like by Monday, we were like 60% down week on week. And at that point, you're like turning, you're basically sending staff home.
Yeah.
Everyone was reading the news back then. Like it felt like it was in free fall. And then by Monday night, Boris is on TV being like, oh yeah, like just simply telling people they shouldn't be going to restaurants. So by the next day, we're 80% down. So, I mean, the whole thing is all over. And at that point, you've already got your food delivery for the rest of the week, and you're sat there with a huge amount of like meat or fish, and probably by the Wednesday, we were just giving it away to staff. We were just like, we were like, look, guys, like, just like, we don't know what's going on here. Furlough hasn't been announced yet, but we're already holding out for something here. But like, take the food home with you, because like, we can't do anything with it. And also, every other restaurant on the street is doing it.
Yeah.
With that said, I do think that was a real opportunity for like restaurants and for employers to like really show who they were. Mm-hmm. I think there were a couple of like employers that week who like they started letting people go.
Yeah.
Like
yeah.
even before the furlough had been announced, they were like cutting hundreds of jobs. Yeah. And I'm really glad that we managed to we held our nerve there and that we were able to support the people we did over that whole period. That was like, look, and that was a crazy one for me because I think obviously for. I effectively went home, as we all did that week, and then grabbed the few people we had in the team who had relevant skills. And I was like, hey, look, like, look, last week you were a restaurant PR manager. You are now an email marketing manager for an e-commerce business. This is what we...
It's quite the change.
Yeah, a great change. But obviously someone like that is still with us today and has gone on this incredible kind of journey in her career and is now a very qualified e-commerce marketing manager. But yeah, I think in January 2020, we did... maybe 10K of coffee, 10,000 pounds of coffee pod sales. And like maybe by, and then we did probably May that year, we did 600,000 or 700,000 pounds of coffee pods. Whoa. It just exploded overnight. But I think there are a lot of similar stories there where the people just, look, everyone was at home. Everyone's quite keen to find something that reminds themselves of their, like the life that they once lived a few weeks previous when they could go outside. So we, and then I think we were really lucky as a business that we managed to both enjoy that, but also then transition it through back into the real world as things came back. Like, I know a lot of that meal, like, a lot of the guys doing like great meal kits, that was obviously just a business that just kind of evaporated.
What I've heard in terms of the pods, that was like the success story of Grind just during COVID and after. And then rumors were about that you guys closed some of the shops just to reduce your expenses, which is obviously the smart thing to do, really.
I mean, it was really tough with those, because we made a couple of closures over COVID. I'd say that one of them that we did was actually one that we'd already planned to do.
Okay.
And to be honest, it wasn't even about necessarily saving costs. It was really about the negotiations you have with the landlord. I don't think I'd ever maybe realized until that point how important, obviously those relationships are incredibly important, right, just in terms of keeping people happy, but that we had a moment there where I don't know, it's one of those things, probably not that many people in London maybe know about this, about restaurants. But obviously there are some really big landlords in London. There are also some really small landlords. Mm. And actually, normally, it's quite normally you quite like your independent
landlord,
because they're friendly, they're easy to deal with. But then there is this nice thing about the quite large landlords that they do have a kind of, they have the freedom to have a five-year view or go, hey, that we're, and a lot of places that we work with, like our restaurant in Liverpool Street, it's the landlord there is, we're just a small fry for them, right? They're selling hundreds of thousands of office space above, and for them it's really important they get the right operator and they get the right mix of operators to support all their rental stuff. But yeah, so we had a couple of like fallouts with landlords. I think it was really a difficult period that whole year, just in terms of having to negotiate those things and having to be there like, guys, like we're not telling you we're not paying rent. We're like, but if we all bleed a little bit,
you need a bit of help.
If we all give each other a little bit of help, then we all make it through here in a year's time. And that was government support and stuff. And that was really great. But we had one or two landlords that were just like, oh no, you're going to pay us your full rent. Yeah, we know you're not trading. I think that was short-sighted of them in places, naming no names. But so we lost a few sites out there. Yeah. To be honest, we came back a little bit stronger in the fact that we started making these kind of Grind coffee trucks. We'd made one a year previous.
Okay.
And there's one. We gave one to the guys at Soho House, and they're Soho Farmhouse. They've got one by the lake there, which is really cool. And we found that they've been really interesting. Like, we can do a really like pure coffee offering. Also, we can just reduce our capex on them, right? I mean, it might cost us 50K to make one of these trucks, because by the time you add all the coffee equipment into it.
Yeah.
But like, if we put it somewhere and it sucks, we can just move it.
Right? Just move it to the
But it's been really interesting to look at what. Like, I really hoped coming out of COVID that we were going to see a new wave of like openings and restaurants, just because the market was completely tanked and so much stuff closed. There were all these like spaces around London that had full £500,000 of commercial kitchen. And all of a sudden, I'd hoped that there was going to be a moment where, you know, you and your friends who might work in a restaurant could just go and pick up a lease somewhere and do your own thing.
Yeah.
And in a couple of places, I think we've seen a bit of that. I guess on paper, I was really hoping we might get to a New York level new opening scene. I got a bit keen there on my expectations.
At that time, back in 2020, what was the aim for Grind? Like, okay, let's develop this pods business. Yeah. or let's try to keep it with the restaurant and see how business hospitality goes for the next couple of years.
I think in 2020 that aim was just survive, right? Like, okay. I think there were some really great operators who just disappeared over that whole period, and people who made the wrong set of decisions there, who didn't find their way through. Particularly if you're like a small independent business. I think we're lucky enough to have the scale that we are. We can borrow money on people, things like that. But there were a lot of people who I think didn't make it through that. I think, to be honest, we were also super aware that we knew that that coffee pod thing might just be like, it might be 18 months there. And actually, ultimately, we were all going to have to go back to our real jobs.
Okay.
So I think that in some ways, though, it was nice because it gave us, suddenly we had this second avenue of the business, and it made us think about a lot more about the brand and what we wanted it to be. And we came out of it with a much more of a, I guess, an ambitious view about just being coffee everywhere, right? We're like, hey, like, where are the coffee moments you have in your life that you can, how can that be a grind coffee you're drinking? Mm. And I guess probably beyond that, there was just that thing of being like, hey, look, it's quite reassuring when you do something that's so out of your wheelhouse and you manage to pull it off.
Yeah.
And I mean, it was a bit like being on an episode of The Apprentice. Well, you're just like, today your job is, oh yeah, like yesterday you were selling coffee in Shoreditch, and the next day you're, I don't know, someone's given you a job in a market somewhere selling fish, and you're like, okay, I guess I'm gonna figure this out. I think it was quite nice to see not only the brand adapt, but also to see that all the people adapt, and we have some really great people.
And it's crazy because, like you said, you just had a few people who you gave positions that they never worked in, but it just worked. And would you be able to tell how many people are working in the operation?
Yeah, so the grind as a whole is about 300 people, right? And I'd say that 250 of those people work, to some extent, in a cafe or a bar or a restaurant. They're making coffee, doing latte art, smashing avocados, doing work on the ground there. Then we probably got about 25 people who work in our, well, this is not really going to add for 300 at all. Maybe it's 200 people who are in our sites. And then we've probably got about 40 people who work in our roastery, who are literally like moving bags of coffee around and roasting it and working incredibly hard there. I think probably beyond that, we've got about 50 people who kind of, some of which are supporting our restaurants. Like you have to have quite a large HR function just to have that many people churning. And then we have probably 30 or 40 people who work on either the e-commerce team or like working on the, or brand, or working with supermarkets trying to get pods out there. And those are people who effectively work in an office, right? Whereas the rest of the business is a little bit more of a 24-hour operation.
So I didn't think you'd had that many employees, but
just
to give the audience a bit of an idea of how many grinds you have, and also obviously you were speaking about trucks with the coffee machine, the new partnerships obviously that you have.
God, I'm trying to think. It's one of those things where as they moved around quite a lot. So I'd say we probably got four proper restaurants, right? And those are things where some of them will employ up to, I don't know, 40, 50 people. And that's, you have a level of a hierarchy there where you have the general managers in those businesses are seriously experienced. They're people who've made real careers in the industry. And we're really lucky to have them. And to some extent, you have people there who are often arguably more senior than the more junior people in the teams that support them, which is really interesting. And it's great that we have that level of just like development within the business. I think we're really lucky coming out of COVID in that we've got a lot of our general managers have been with the business for 6 or 7 years now, which is really cool that they managed to have retained people. And similar with kind of head chefs. But yeah, and then what was the question?
I'd say we've got
about 8 physical locations, then we've got about 6 coffee trucks at the moment. And obviously the coffee trucks employ like one or two or three or maybe 4 people each, so that in reality like your 6 coffee trucks employs less people than one big restaurant does.
Crazy, isn't it?
About on Sunday, I've been to Grind in London Bridge.
Oh, really?
It's really cool, very nice. But actually, as you said, we can see there's a lot of stuff, a lot of people. Maybe it's the biggest you have. I don't know, the London Bridge.
So we've got one in Greenwich that's probably bigger in terms of square footage. But like that one with kind of one big thing. Greenwich has, we're quite lucky where we've got that like part, we can partition it. So you can flex the size of the restaurant to what you need. I think there are some like people like Dishoom do a really good job of that thing where like, they can just partition off parts of the restaurant.
Oh, yeah.
Completely. Yeah, which is great for staff costs and stuff.
So, which is super interesting because you have different models of income. And which one is the most interesting now after COVID, obviously, like the, because you were talking about restaurants obviously closing down for us as well as Comptoir Gourmand, we had to close four shops and then reopen, close some, reopen some. And yeah, we had to adapt like anybody, any other companies in hospitality. Yeah. Now in this position now, what is the main source of income that you guys are exploiting?
Yeah. So I'd say like we're right now, we're roughly split. I guess we're probably split three ways at the moment, which would be restaurants, the kind of e-commerce business. That's people on grind.co.uk buying coffee pods. Mm-hmm. And I'd say we probably have the same business a third time as a mix of different things. So we supply all the coffee for Soho House, like internationally. So if you have a coffee in a Soho House anywhere in the world, it will be a Grind coffee, which is great for us as a partnership. And then we also just roast and sell a lot of coffee to people in offices and things like that. So, well, more recently, we've actually gone into supermarkets, which is a really in whole other ball game, right? And that's been incredibly interesting to learn about it. Although, unlike previous times when we've added new parts to the business, we've hired in people there who know it inside out. But that's like a whole other planet. So we're now live in a couple of Tesco's as about 2 days ago.
Okay.
And I've unfortunately not seen any of them yet, but I'm quite looking forward to seeing how that goes.
Yeah.
And it's also just interesting to see, I guess, grind within the kind of coffee space, the coffee space that we might know is probably not that premium as specialty coffee goes. But like in a Tesco, we are the most expensive thing on the shelf by some margin, right? Whereas obviously in London and perhaps in the world and the kind of the world that we might live in, like you can spend way more than grind. And if anything, we quite like the fact that we're the accessible end of specialty coffee. But yes, I think we're probably split between, I guess you could call that kind of wholesale retail, and then D2C, direct to consumer, our website, and then the cafes and the restaurants. With that said, I think it's changed, like, the restaurant business we came back to after COVID, or the cafe business we came back to, is really different to the one that we like. The one that we put to bed in the beginning of 2020, when we came back to it, once it slowly came back to life, it came back to life like quite a different thing.
It was a bit weird at the beginning, with the reopening. We all forgot how to act, or just going to a restaurant, or just losing these social skills.
Yeah, and it comes with the job as well. The social skills that now you see in restaurants and cafe, bars and everything, the customer service has completely changed.
In which way? In a better way?
Worse. Yeah. And it's getting better-ish, I feel like.
Yeah.
But it was so hard for the past 3 years to be able to educate those people to do good customer service, because you were asking the normality of before COVID. Of how to serve, and for them it was complete new after COVID, and you have to say, oh, you have to smile like 24 hours, you have to do this, you have to do that, and then you were scared that they were gonna quit their job.
I think because we were in lockdown, we were in some version of lockdown for 2.5 years, by the time that we came out there were so many like new factors, right? Even if you remove the kind of COVID element, the fact that we didn't go to restaurants for 2 years, there's this thing where we came out and everything was way more expensive. That Brexit had happened, and therefore we've made the vast majority of London's hospitality workforce pretty uncomfortable with how welcome they were here, right?
Yeah.
And which just immediately I think London's standard of service dropped to some level there as a result of that. And then, but not only that, just a huge number of really talented people just removed themselves from the workforce over COVID and didn't come back to the UK, which just changed the dynamic of that. But also just things like, just young people who'd like not, I mean, you had people who moved to London during COVID and they'd never been to London, lived in London for 2 years without going to a restaurant. And you're like, just even just like the people coming up, right? That everyone lost 2.5 years of their life. My big thing with it was that I've got no data on this, right? I've got no grind data nor anyone else's data. But like, I just think people just leave, people go out a lot less than they used to. People, we all went away. Spent 2 years at home, and when we came back, go out of the house or go out for dinner 25% less than they used to, but they feel like they've got back to normal. And to be honest, the worst effect has been that, late night is just like, late night in London is fucked. I live in Shoreditch, so I'm probably out in Shoreditch 2 or 3 nights a week, and I'm just there and I'm like, oh, okay, it is it's 10 p.m. and like, I can name you the bars from 10 p.m. that are still available. It's like you've got Home Bar and Found Bar, who are great little like great spots, have been there for 10 years. They close at 10 or 11. Then you've got Kalukale at midnight. And beyond that, you've got Shoreditch House. And that's, or God forbid, a strip club. And you're like, yeah, that is it. But yeah, yeah. You go to that like the horrible ball pool.
Oh,
pit.
Yeah.
Bally Ballerson. Yeah. Yeah. I don't know. It's like supposed to be this like exciting 24-hour city. And you're like, there's
nothing. Yeah. No, it's true. I love it. And especially Soho as well.
Yeah.
That change completely.
But even like Shoreditch, we used to be like the place for party, for like late night drinks.
Yeah.
But not much late night.
No. But they've got the night czar, right? And they're the night czar. And it's basically, there's something like, it's like when she was appointed night czar, she named five venues as being her like favorite late night venues in London. Yeah. And it's like, since she was night czar, three of the five have closed. And you're like, come on.
Oh my.
Like, this
oh,
is just, God. This just sucks. Yeah. But that.
Yeah,
so it was a whole new world.
Yeah, it is. And come to the pods, because obviously, one question I'll say bluntly, but are you dependent on Nespresso, the machine?
Yeah, so like we obviously our pods are Nespresso pods. So Nespresso pods have like come in like two. I don't know if anyone knows that stuff about this kind of things. In some ways it's quite boring, but there are basically two types of Nespresso pods. So there's an Nespresso pod that they invented in the 80s, which is. Which has been around for years, right? And it's like one in three houses in the UK has an espresso machine, which is crazy, right? It's like the level to which of their like penetration through the UK and then through Europe is just absolutely insane. And then more recently, they lost the patent on it. So other people like us are able to make the pods. And so they've developed a new thing called Virtuo, which is just the same thing, except it spins the pod when you make it. And it's made, I think it's made, I don't know, without trying to be getting in any trouble, I think it was made intentionally complicated so that they were able to have something they could license. Because, of course, they would love to sell you a Virtuo pod because only they can sell you the Virtuo machine because only they can sell you Virtuo pods. Mm. It was a great, like, printer ink model where, like, you can buy the machines there from them for 30 quid because they know that in order to use it, you're going to have to keep buying their pods.
Okay.
So, yeah. So, on one hand, we are reliant on Nespresso, but, like, we also think that we bring a lot of people to the category, right? We sell a lot of Nespresso machines ourselves. We know that we get a lot of people in who wouldn't have bought Nespresso pods unless they could have the compostable ones that we have that you can just throw away in your garden or your food waste. So we're probably doing them a favor to some extent.
Okay, so that's answered my second question because I was going to ask, say, if they had a new pod that it will be unique to them, why would they not just stop the machine?
Yeah, other people can make the machines now. Okay. So like the machine, unfortunately, for Nespresso is just out there in the world. And I think consumers also just because the legal battle around it was so publicized, I think they know that if they can buy these, they can buy the supermarket pots. And every major supermarket will have their own blend or whatever. And there are plenty of like other like specialty roasters now doing this as well since we've done it. And a lot of them make really great pods. But I think that people know that it's like that the original style capsules really lock them in. And to be fair, I think years ago when we first set out on this, I was always really worried about the quality of the product just because there's only quite a small amount of coffee in an espresso pod compared to when you might make an espresso. It might put like 18, 20 grams of espresso in it, whereas in a pod, there's only between 5 and 7 grams per pod.
Mm.
But actually, it's crazy. It's a crazy, like, efficient piece of invention in the fact that you go that an espresso is effectively one espresso that using a third of the amount of coffee. And sure, it tastes different, right? There's nothing, it's never really going to be as good as one that we make ourselves in our cafes or people can make themselves at home if you spend 10 grand on the machine and you have the grinder and you get the right beans. And most importantly, you know what you're doing. But like, it's not that far off given it's like got a third of the coffee in it, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, it's a bit like if someone made a bottle of wine that only used a third of the grapes, I'd expect that to be radically different.
A bit different, yeah.
You wouldn't be keen on that one, would you?
No, I will not buy for sure.
It'd be quite watery.
Yeah,
it would
which
be.
Which kind of makes sense. And just but because we are on the question for the pods, so we know like for the last couple of years, we saw a lot of advertising in the tube, etc. Are you the guy who made this advertising? Be real.
I used to be. So I still get involved with it. So like the Jacob Elordi one that we did recently, that one did quite well because it was very... quite somewhat offensive. That one was me. So like, I still work really closely with the team. But no, we've got a whole team of people who are really great at this. Like people who write like copywriters and working with kind of agencies where we need to like have that support on that. It's crazy. As I said, my job's a long way from washing dishes at Shoreditch Grind now.
Oh, now,
but
yeah.
It's been a really interesting journey. And to be honest, I think like a lot of the same skills have just carried me through there.
Of course.
Yeah.
Really, yeah, I can imagine. Fun. Yeah. And now, so obviously as chief marketing officer, who do you go to so
where do you go to?
to yeah. What is your mission now, as in with your team? Obviously, I guess you have a big meeting with the people that are relevant for a project.
So we're a really, on some ways, for a business that is so broad, we're actually quite a small business, right? Like you think about we're now doing coffee in cans that you can buy in Tesco, and we have cafes, and we're like the only businesses doing as many things that we are businesses like Starbucks and Tesco, or Starbucks and Costa rather, who are just like enormous businesses. So structurally at Grind, I work with David, our CEO and our founder, and Dan, our CFO. And I'd say that we're involved in as much as we can humanly be involved with. But actually, a lot of the day-to-day of the business is run by our directors below that. So and a lot of them are, some of them are people who've been with the business for a while, and some of them are people who we've brought in real experts into roles there. So we've got a brand director and a D2C director. And these people are really, I think that they're more than capable of running businesses of their own. And so, in some ways, in some ways they really do, right? In fact, one of them was the woman who's in charge of a lot of our kind of retail and kind of supermarket stuff now. Actually, her business was one that we acquired. It was a kind of canned coffee business that we acquired about maybe a year or two ago. Okay. And then we folded that business into Grind, and she became what is now our kind of B2B wholesale director. And yeah, like, sure, when she first arrived, she was in perhaps a different role there. We knew very quickly that in a lot of ways, what Grind has acquired there was really her and her skill set and the small team of people that came with her. And then, yeah, but it's been really exciting. But like, we have them run a lot of the businesses.
Yeah.
And a lot of the time I work on, frankly, random other projects that we've got going on. Or perhaps looking at what the next version of the thing we're doing is.
Yeah.
So that's great.
Yeah. And obviously being with them for 11 years, at what point did you see the turning point of Grind going rocket high?
I think there were probably a couple of moments when we were really like, when we were doing more openings. There's something I really miss about doing big proper openings with, I don't know, teams of kind of 30 or above, where you go, you make something real, right? And I think something that I miss a lot in our digital, now we exist, a lot of this now exists in the digital kind of world. And for me, I spent probably between 2020 and probably end of last year doing almost exclusively that, right? And that I was working on the kind of Shopify store and the internet. And it was really weird there because like I'd spent, I don't know, 7-8 years before that doing like building kind of restaurants and opening new places and being like, at some point you go and like, sure, I wasn't building anything with my hands. I wouldn't be very good at screwing anything together. But like we would go around a empty bank building that used to be a bank on London Bridge. And then we'd spend some time looking at floor plans and working with kind of operations team to make sure that we can make this thing great. And then all of a sudden you give someone some money and then and then very quickly there are 25 guys screwing the whole thing together. And then a month later, you've then got, someone's hired a whole team of 30, 40 people in there and someone's doing the kind of onboarding training. And then a month after that, like there are people there eating food. And I don't think people who work in fully digital businesses, and which to be fair, massive like number of people, people with email jobs, I don't think they realize that how rewarding it is to see something real with your
completely.
Eyes, especially in a hospitality setting where it's like the general public are there. It's like, it's not something like we're not building it on a mountainside somewhere. This is, you become someone's like day to day, and also you exist in their lives. You're like, I get emails from people who are like, oh, I had my first date with blah blah at Shoreditch Grind 8 years ago. Now I'd like to have my baby's christening at Shoreditch Grind.
And you're like,
this is, you're part of the fabric of, I think I'm really lucky with coffee, coffee in particular. It's just being like, you get to be a part of someone's life.
It's an experience.
Yeah. And I'm sure that I'm sure they're not thinking, they don't see themselves as being like, oh, I'm like, they don't wear the Grind t-shirt or they perhaps don't see themselves as being as part of my life. But I'm like, oh, this is like, we did something here, right? Like we did, the world would be materially different if we were not doing this.
You're part of the story.
Yeah, and you're part, and you're like, and when we were doing it online, and I sat there online between 2020 and 2023, watching our kind of revenue per month go from £10,000 to £1 million. And you know what? it didn't feel as good as building the, as building something real, right? Because it's just a number. It's a line. The line just goes up on a screen. Yeah. And yeah, okay, okay. If I go out to our fulfillment center or whatever, there are hundreds of people packing things into boxes and whatever. Yeah. And that's great. And I love that what's afforded us the business. I love that it's afforded like the fact that we've been able to grow into this and the amazing kind of talent we've been able to acquire as a result of it. But like, you know what? Like, you didn't. No one sends me emails being like, "Oh, I went on a had a date." Or like I met my wife through having a Grind Coffee Pod subscription. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I think hospitality, that's what it's about, right? Yeah.
The stories I hear from my girlfriend at Cascruz. I get that all the time.
Talking about a lot of Cascruz. I should
get paid for this. Yeah. Like,
this podcast sponsored by...
By Cascruz and Picnic.
Yeah. No, but yeah, you're completely right. Yeah. So the emotions that you give to the people, the attachments. That's what we were talking about before the starting the podcast, about employees understanding what hospitality is all about. And it's that joy that you get out of it. Yeah. And yeah. It's not advertised enough for that kind of job. No. And yeah, it really creates that that relation between the brand and the customer. And I completely agree with you. Like, I've done a few openings and there's nothing more.
Electric, right? Yeah. Super electric. And like, it's also really nice. Even having done that, like, we do the building project. And you know what? I'm there. Me and a couple of people will be there the night before. And we're there like, fuck, maybe this is the one we like. Maybe this is the one we fucked up. Like, maybe this is the one where we really I don't know, someone picked the wrong tiles and like the vibe just doesn't come together. Mm. And then, you know, the morning of, you get a load of people in there and staff, not customers. Mm. The customers are great. Let's thank God for them. But the staff in there and someone puts the music up a bit too loud and all of a sudden people are talking to each other and the customers haven't even arrived yet. And you're like, and I go in there and I'm like, oh, we're going to be fine. Maybe we didn't fuck this one up. Maybe we live to see another day. Yeah. And it is just, I don't know how you could tell a teenager that how rewarding that is in terms of, you don't know how you could. But I think that especially when other jobs are increasingly isolated, right? Like, people doing kind of customer service roles, they can do them entirely from home. And you're like, oh, like, I don't think people realize the gap between what that is, what that means for your life versus working in a cafe or a restaurant. Yeah. And yeah, the hours are really hard, but it's on a human level, it's really rewarding.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. Well, especially the contact with.
Yeah, I think it's probably because the idea people have about the industry, all the bad side of the industry, a lot of hours working on the weekend, and it's not physical, very easy, it's physical. Yeah. But also, you have to keep staying in this industry for 6 months, a year, 2 years, 3 years. And then you realize how beautiful it is to do an opening, to train a team, to develop relation with your customers.
Yeah, and you need to, you know, I think if that is for any job, you know, you give the best out of yourself. Maybe you don't do the best job, but at least you give the most and you're going to learn a lot out of it. And then from that, you filter what you liked, what you didn't like. And you can do that on multiple jobs and then filter down to what you really want to do.
Yeah, 100%.
And you'll probably be in with a load of surprise, probably like you. You're probably the pure example. You started to work at Grind 11 years ago. And you were studying something completely different. And then you come to realize that actually there's those doors that are opening to you and you're going forward and you're like, oh, I like this.
There's also a lot to be said just like figuring stuff out. Like, I think there are a lot of people who like they're worried they don't have that much of a plan. And you're like, oh, it's probably going to be okay. It's going to be okay, bro. Like,
relax.
Yeah. Take my hand, I'll show you.
That's the thing, because I feel like the industry of the hospitality, maybe you can think about hospitality as or waiters or a cook or the chef. But like, for example, you're working in hospitality right now, actually. Yeah, and we're all working in just a different level as a business owner, at the CMO, I'm in sales. But we're all like all related to the hospitality industry, but we're not necessarily on the floor.
But there's a community to it. People, especially because there's unfortunately in some like roles, a level of staff turnover means that if you're there for 2 or 3 years, like you walk into restaurants you've never been to before and people, right? And like, it's really weird because like obviously I meet a lot of people now who've never worked hospitality or never worked anything close to what they would consider as being hospitality. And they're like, we're starting this online group for community for people in the marketing industry. And you're like, you didn't have to try to do that in hospitality, right? A really good friend of mine is someone he's been in the industry, kind of doing, I've been loads of different places for the last like 10, 15 years now. I was in Morocco with him in some like back street in Marrakesh. And we were in a bar and the guy behind the bar is, and he's like, oh yeah, we used to work together in Paris 7 years ago. And you're like, I didn't even know he worked. He was like, I did 6 months in Paris, whatever. And you're like, oh, okay. You just bump into these people, right? And the level to which, like, especially because all the people are probably in restaurants a lot of the time, even when they're not working at them, right? Like, it's like a great, like, culture to it. Right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Eating and drinking is a good percentage of everyone's life.
Yeah, exactly.
First of all, survive, and then, you know, the whole enjoyment about it.
But
and,
I think eventually most people, I know I certainly do, like, just I structure my social life around eating and drinking.
Yeah, so completely.
I don't really meet friends without, I'm like, oh, I'm gonna go meet
somewhere and have a walk. And...
yeah, for a dinner or for a drink or for coffee. Yeah, yeah, it's a weird one. There is a joy in going to restaurants on your own.
I love it.
I love restaurants. Yeah. I was Cast Crew, my obligatory, haven't mentioned that in 10 minutes. Yeah. I went to Cast Crew on my own maybe the weekend before last. And like, you're there and you sit at the, find somewhere you can sit at the bar.
Yeah.
A couple glasses of wine, have a bit too much food. It's great. Just easy.
It's amazing.
Yeah.
I love it. Yeah. Yeah. That's why I'm quite often there, to be honest. Just on your own like this. Yeah. No, but it's true. I don't know whether or not if it's to be part of the industry that you can enjoy that moment, because when you're on your own and you're not on your phone, you kind of examine how the place works.
Especially when you're somewhere that's quite interesting. And both, and that can be somewhere very small or can be somewhere very large. Like you go in there and it's nice to spend some time not on your phone, because it's so, I know, I find, like, right here, it's so easy just to be like, oh, like, I have one moment in my own thoughts and I'm there with my phone out. And actually, like, it's quite nice, right? And just especially when you've got somewhere where there's a real vibe, right? Yeah. Like, you can, and you sit there and you just like, oh, like, you get to take it all in, which just feels good, right? Completely. It feels really good.
Yeah. When you start speaking to the staff members.
Yeah.
And you really start appreciating, asking questions.
I always quite like making conversation with people. Mm. And I find that there's some people now who, like, really find that, like, quite difficult in that, customers are a bit snappier somehow. I think, I think we talk about, like, standard service in London, but I think the customers got worse as well.
Yeah, I completely agree.
I think it completely depends about the area as well, especially in London. Yeah. If you're going to Shoreditch, to Hackney, or to Mayfair, you have three different kind of customers.
Yeah.
Very tricky to understand.
I went to what's it called, Josephine?
Chelsea.
We're just going from one bistro to another here, aren't we? Just like, like bistro tour of London.
But that just opened, didn't it?
Yeah. And to be fair, I never go that far west, right? It's actually really, I always think it's crazy in terms of London. And you go abroad to another city and you're like, oh, I want it here and here. Whereas, like, in London, you're like, oh, you live. And I know that I do a really bad job of leaving my little bubble. And then, and I was there. And I was, on one hand, you go, like, okay, firstly, it was great, right? It's beautiful. The food was amazing. Like, it does a really, and I think it's really hard, especially if you're opening like a bistro. It's like very hard to produce the vibe of something that needs to feel like it's been there for 100 years. And they've done a really good job of that. But like the people, and maybe because it's a new opening, it's probably like a tough reservation to get, I'm sure, if you want to go on a Saturday night. But like, I was there not on a Saturday night. And then, and they're quite like, just quite like standoffish, and like they were quite dressed up. And it's just the area thing.
Yeah, right? you mean the customers?
The customers. The staff were great.
Okay.
The place was great. But and it was very, like, I don't know, that kind of like, people wearing like high heels. And I was like, what is...
maybe it's a bit like, more posh.
When's the last time? I can't remember. Yeah, I can't recall the last time I saw high heels in the restaurant, to be honest.
Around here, it's all pretty cobbled, right? You're probably having quite a hard time. But like, I don't know. To be fair, I think it's probably because it's a new opening. It's obviously, it's got some incredible people attached to it. It's probably, we get so few new openings in London, right? And it's probably because it's on, I'm sure it's on some list of.
And he's the big chef, he's Claude Boisy. So it's a famous chef, Michelin star.
And I guess also like in that area, it's a bit like people will go there, they'll see the Michelin, that he's got a Michelin star, and they'll be like, okay, like, I'll go there. And perhaps they might not even know what they're going, they might think they're going to Sexy Fish, who knows?
I never tried Sexy Fish personally, but
You know something about Sexy Fish, actually? I'm Deptford High Street, that's where I live.
There's gonna be a new Sexy Fish.
No, but one of the chefs, I think it was the head chef,
is a shark bait place, shark bait?
Next to shark bait,
have you been there? You're good. Yeah.
Oh my god, the best sushi I've ever had.
Really?
I haven't been to Japan, but best sushi I've ever had.
In London.
That sounds...
But,
I thought it was like oysters and stuff. Is it sushi?
No, so Shark Bait is the chef that opened Sexy Fish in New York and in London is not Shark Bait. It's one next to it. And
Going from Sexy Fish to Deptford is insane. To be fair, Deptford High Street ought to... I grew up in... Peckham. So I knew the area, but I'm like, it's insane how Deptford High Street was not like, someone should have figured that out 10 years ago, right?
Yeah.
I mean, it's happening now.
It's like, happening now.
There's a lot of really nice...
It's crazy. And the first guest that we had on the podcast...
Dom Taylor.
Yeah, he wanted to open his restaurant in Deptford. He nearly got it, but Salt, the pizza place, took over. But yeah, he wanted to do his own restaurant, and the guy is so talented. Yeah, and damn it, I wish he did.
I've not even been to Shark Bait, but you get a couple of like serious things next door to each other, and someone opens a little cafe, and all of a sudden you've got, but also you get a community there, right? Like, every one of those people knows every one of the other members of staff there. That sounds like a great place to be, right? Like, let's just go right now. I'm thinking, that'd be a good, I'd love,
Completely, yeah. And that's what Deptford is actually growing into, and it's great. I just need to get the name of that restaurant. It's not Shark Bait, but the other one is it's just a very hard name to remember, but it's next to it.
For listeners, it's next to Shark Bait.
Exactly.
Shark Bait and something it's called, right? It's like Shark Bait and... I can't remember,
but next to it, anyways.
Very well reviewed.
But you'll see, he only has 5 stars and he's got a lot of reviews. Food is amazing.
Where's the food?
It's half. So the guy's Vietnamese, but he's doing a fusion of Vietnamese and Japanese.
Okay.
And it's amazing. Yeah. I love eating there. Seriously, it's just, wow.
Just to finish the podcast, if you can tell us maybe your five, let's say your top three favorite place to eat in London.
Okay, I'd say, you know what? It's really funny with restaurants. I used to live by the Ace Hotel. Hoi Polloi used to be in the Ace.
Okay, yeah.
And it's a hotel in the short itself, Hoi Polloi. It was run by the Bistro Tech guys. And you know what? Like, that was not in anyone's list of the best restaurants in London. But you know what? It was my favorite list. It was like, I was there probably twice a week. I'd go in there and have the burgers great because it's the Bistro Tech guys. It was like, I had a great time in there.
Okay.
But that closed in COVID. So let's get to it a bit more recently. So I'd say,
God, such a tough one.
No, I really can't say Cascrew. Although I've been there so many times.
You can.
No, I think that's cheating. But I think I'd say, okay, new restaurants. I went to Bistro Freddy. God, we're hitting the Bistro. Freddy. Yeah, that was really good fun. That little corner where it's been a few different things over the last like few years, and it's really good in there, right? Yeah. Like, it's really good. It's really like good fun.
Yeah, they've made, for me, it's a mix of Cascrew and Zadel.
Way. And then I'd say Escocesa in Stoke Newington is a bit of a rogue pick, right? So I think, I should really look this up in advance.
What's the name again?
It's called, I might be pronouncing it wrong. Might be Escocesa, might be Escocesa. Either way. So it is owned by there's basically a lot of the best seafood out of Scotland is, quite a lot of it is exported to Spain, right? Because in Spain, people will pay for it.
Mm.
And in Scotland, largely people won't, right? And especially the kind of the real high quality is there. So it's opened, I think, by a Scottish couple.
Okay.
Maybe one of the Scottish. Yeah. And basically, I think the word is the Spanish word for Scottish.
Okay.
And it's basically a very good Spanish seafood restaurant. And it's like, I think they've opened one in Soho. It's called something different. I'm going to quietly look up on my phone. Escocesa Soho. And it's just like, look, they do half price oysters before 7 p.m. I probably go there once a week at least. Like, just like great, hit the classics, right? Oysters, a couple of beers, garlic prawns, I go in there, it's quite early on, it gets quite busier later on. And it's just like a great neighborhoody restaurant, right?
Like, sounds like a good restaurant. Yeah. Yeah.
It's just like, I could probably eat there 5 nights a week. If not 7 nights a week, and be very comfortable. And the staff are incredible. Like, they've got a great team in the kitchen there. It's just like one of those really like really good neighborhood restaurant on Stoke Newington Church Street, which is obviously quite far away from where we are now, and certainly far away from Deptford.
Yeah.
But you know what? It's worth the journey, if I can say. Morisco is good fun. That's their one in Soho. I think it's the same people.
Morisco.
I think that's probably what will be my number three.
You can say a pizza, a bar.
A pizza. I went to Speedboat recently in Chinatown.
Oh, wow.
Speedboat. So it is. Who's opened it? I'm going to butcher this because I've no idea where in Asia the food is from. But it's great. It's an incredible kind of like bizarre looking venue. And then they have an incredible bar there. It's Thai food. It's very weird. This TV's showing Thai sports on quite a lot of the time.
Oh,
like,
wow.
So, but it's a new opening. I should really know more about who opened this, because I think this is not like a random Chinatown spot, but rather something like a new opening that was really great. It's a couple of doors down from, what was that? I can't even remember. Yeah, where else have I been recently that was really good? Other than I can't ever possibly mention Cast Crew ever again. Pearly Queen is so good.
Oh, okay. I heard about Pearly Queen.
So it opened probably November last year by Spitalfield. It's Tom Brown from Cornerstone. I think there are a few of those are quite new places there, but it's really nice to see, I don't know, places like Manteca and Bistro Freddy. Yeah. And it sounds crazy to think like actually new openings in Shoreditch aren't as common as I might like, but those like all on my doorstep. I love all three. So, still end up in Padella quite a lot of the time, just eating that for lunch, then being sleepy in the afternoon.
Brilliant. I think we're almost done.
Yeah. I've got a last question, actually.
Go for it.
Apart from grind, obviously, I guess you're a coffee lover.
Oh, the famous question about what is your favorite coffee?
Yeah. No, but like, which, obviously, not being biased, but like, which other coffee do you love it in London? Because we've got such a great coffee scene.
Yeah. I think Sense Arabica is just like a great operator. Okay. I think there are, it's been really interesting for Grind, because we've been on, like, coffee's been on such a journey, right? And there were some great coffee shops that have like disappeared over the years, unfortunately. Mm. I think that Percentage Arabica on Broadway Market is like a great, it's just like a, it's so cool in there. And the coffee is great. They take it really seriously. Yep. They've managed to make something that feels really new in a market that otherwise is still quite a lot of the same kind of hipster stuff.
Yeah.
I think it also makes it really super accessible for people. Mm. Yeah.
All right. I think that sums it up.
Yeah. Thank you very much, Ted. Thank you very much for your time today.
Yeah, thanks for
the
one.
It was very fun.
We could go for another hour easily.
Yeah.
Well, see you next week. Right?
Yeah. Yeah. We'll definitely do the podcast in Cascroot.
Yeah.
You know what? We should do
the Cascroot number podcast. 2. Yeah. Just like set the mics up at the bar and just sit there.
Yeah, in the bar. We're going at 5 or 6 before the big rush.
Do that Sunday night.
Are you in one of the little Polaroids on Cascroot? That's my personal.
I am.
Who have I got to talk to? Like a kiss Polaroid.
Yeah, you just kiss one and put it on there.
Just chance it.
Yeah.
You can bring one yourself and be like, slap it up.
Yeah. Whenever the waitress are outside. But great. Thank you for all the insights and all these stories that you had. Yeah. You told. I hope it'll give a bit of a broad idea of your whole journey from working on the floor, cleaning dishes, until being the chief marketing officer for Grind. And yeah, it's been so interesting there. So thank you so much. Brilliant.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you very
Cheers,
much.
Cheers, guys.
And hit us up on Instagram, follow us. We're all on all the platforms.
Spotify, podcasts.
All the podcast platforms again. And we'll
see you next week.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Hopefully. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Take care.